Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name, you will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey everybody, welcome in. It's David Summers, and here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time. Let's get wall-to-wall, tree-top tall, with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. All right, Ron, I got to tell you, in Dothan, Alabama, here in the Deep South, it is cold this morning. It's like 32 right now. So I'm thinking where you are there in the Smoky Mountains, it's probably sunny at 75.
Yeah, it's sunny. It's sunny, but it's closer to 25.
Wow. Okay, so you guys are really getting the frost bite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. And I think on Friday, a couple of days from now, we're gonna be getting snow. Maybe some of that they got up north of us in Kentucky and across the middle part of the country from about Kansas to the East Coast where they had all that big snow. I think we're going to get a couple of days of that Friday and Saturday.
Hey, do you love to get out and drive around in the snow?
Oh, man, it's wonderful.
All right, good deal. Yeah,
man, I kind of stay out of the snow as much as possible. I'm an old Southern boy, and I'm not accustomed to do much driving in the snow.
Yeah, I'd have to stay in my pajamas all day and just stay my big butt at home. I think that's where I would be. Hey, I got to tell you, welcome back, everybody. We've had a lot to cover and a lot to cover in this one. So, Ron, let's get right to it. Set us up with the card for Christmas week, 1980.
Well, okay, but before we go there, Dave, I kind of want to explain the significance, man, of the drawing power for wrestling companies and their fans. We're going to talk about this Christmas week, and it's a great week for wrestling fans. I always considered Christmas Day all the way through January 1st, New Year's Day. That 8-day period is one of the best for all the wrestling companies across the country. And it was nice to take advantage, man, of those, every one of those days, because fans are having a good time, the kind of partying, man. So oddly enough, for buildings, though, that held these weekly matches for us, those nights between Christmas and New Year's Eve weren't that popular for other kinds of events, and therefore kind of made it easier to book them when necessary. So, I always considered that we were pretty smart in the way we handled these Christmas weeks and these really popular weeks by making those smart wrestling companies even more profitable between those wonderful days every year. and it gave the wrestlers a special Christmas gift, I can tell you that. Because the payoffs are really good.
Wow. Okay. I never really thought about it like that, but it's always a good, happy time of year. And what better time to see some great wrestling? All right. So how did you, as a booker and owner, plan those 8 days from Christmas through New Year's Day in 1980, for example?
Well, you know, most owners didn't treat that week any different than others. I mean, they didn't seem to recognize it, a lot of them did, and those that did have profited from it very much. And so most bookers were too focused basically on their next angle to even think about the owners you know, possibly needing to adjust the schedule so that all the wrestlers could benefit. So could they as well. By getting some big crowds, it doesn't hurt a booker's chances of keeping his job. So for us, we changed not only the night, but also the building in a couple of the instances to take advantage of that Christmas night and the New Year's night in 1980 that both fell on a Thursday, happened to be a Thursday in 1980. We moved Mobile, Alabama, which regular night was always a Tuesday. And we even exchanged the building. We had an opportunity to get out of Expo Hall to go on the Thursday night, which would be Christmas night, to get out of Expo Hall, and nobody was renting the big arena, so we moved it into the main arena, 10,000-seater. So our company and our wrestlers, along with the fans, were going to be celebrating that time of year, and you know, we wanted to take advantage of it.
I always say you didn't miss a thing. All right, so what about the rest of the week?
Well, the next night in the week was on Friday, and that was obviously Dothan's night, man. And it became the time of the year, you know, we knew that this was going to automatically be a bigger than usual Friday night because of, you know, like I said, people are celebrating. They're having a good time. They want to go somewhere, and wow, wrestling was a great product. So the next night of that week was a Saturday. And I was always the hardest night of the week to find a building that you could rent, especially for a regular schedule. We didn't have the one of our major towns on a Saturday night because we couldn't find a building that would give up all their Saturday nights. So as I said earlier, but it wasn't that way at Christmas time. So we normally ran a random smaller city. We called it a spot show on those Saturday nights. And so Montgomery, which normally ran on Wednesday nights, but in 1980, that was Christmas Eve. And you didn't want to run any sports event on Christmas Eve.
No, it's one of the worst
nights of the year, right?
Yeah.
It's a family night, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to stay at home. So we weren't going to, you know, we weren't going to run Montgomery at all on that night. So we had to take a different look at it.
Well, it seems sort of obvious that Christmas Eve was going to be a bad night for wrestling. But now that you say, I mean, to me, it really makes sense that it's not anything that you want to mess with because it is a family night. All right. So how did you handle that situation with Montgomery? What'd you do?
Well, we checked with the building and obviously they didn't have it rented on a Saturday night. So we switched that night from a Wednesday that would have been horrible. We took that available Saturday night, and that may be the best night of the week, right? Saturdays, weekends are big time, you know, people want to get out and do things. So, so we took advantage of that Saturday, and we were looking forward, man, to having a record crowd in Montgomery. So the next night was on a Sunday, and that was Pensacola's wrestling night. And it was going to be a big one because it was during that special Christmas week we anticipated and we were hoping for. And then on Monday night, December the 29th, 1980, was Birmingham's more normal night. And again, we knew it was going to be a great crowd because it was during Christmas week and all the way up to New Year's week. So since we had moved Mobile from their normal Tuesday night to the Thursday to get in the big building, we moved the normal Thursday night town, which was Panama City, to Tuesday night, where Mobile normally ran. But that gave us our normal six-day week, and it also gave Panama an opportunity to maybe have a big night as well.
Well, that had to be quite a bit of work to get it all done. So did you think the crowds would be anywhere near those, I mean, during the Triple World Championship events like a couple of months earlier?
Well, not dollar-wise, because the prices were raised for all those events. But actual number of fans, we thought, maybe. Let's see. And, in fact, at the end of this studcast, when I always give everyone the attendances for the four major markets, I think I'm going to add Pensacola and I'll add Panama City to the totals for the six-day week rather than just talking about the four towns. And at that point, Dave, maybe you can tell me what you think about it for the last week in 1980.
All right. Hearing those attendance figures is always one of my favorite things that you do, Stud. I think it's pretty cool how you lay all that out for us. I look forward to that every time. All right. So tell us about the card beginning on Christmas Day 1980 and ending 6 days later in Panama City, Florida.
Well, the opening match was a surprise to almost all the fans. It was somebody that they had cheered big time in 1979 when he first came down in that area in the deep south along the Gulf Coast. And when he was partnering a lot with my brother and I, but then they booed him like crazy in the first part of 1980 because he had definitely a change of heart. So until on April the 8th, 1980, he suffered this horrible back injury in an eight-man tag in Mobile, Alabama's main arena. We're going to be in for Christmas night. And he was told that he was never going to wrestle again, and he retired from the sport. So after months of suffering, he began to work on his back problem, and then 9 months after his injury, he returned to the same ring in Mobile's main arena on Christmas night, the exact same place he was injured. And I'm talking about my cousin Jimmy Golden, and he was literally making a comeback in his match against Oki Shekina. Mm. In the second match, Johnny Valiant faced Iron Mike Masters. Third match was a handicap match. Mr. Saito was going to wrestle two guys at once, Bob Evans and Burrhead Jones. And then the fourth match was for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. The champion, Jerry Stubbs, was defending against the new masked man, a guy that was called the Shadow. And in a Southeastern Championship match, the Tennessee Stud was defending against Cowboy Ron Bass. And for the Southeastern Tag Championship, Bob and Brad were getting their second shots at the champions, Dennis Condrey and Randy Rhodes. Seventh match of the night was an all-against-all 15-man elimination match. A match in which, when you lost, you returned to the dressing room, and the match went on until just one guy remained that hadn't been beaten, and that guy was going to win $5,000.
All right, that was a really special Christmas card. The return of Jimmy Golden, a one-against-two Saito handicap match, three championship matches, and a $5,000 elimination match with seven matches in all. That's a great card. All right, so how did the TV show open up?
Well, this TV show was starting exactly as it began in December of 1980 with Jimmy Golden just returning to the ring and being introduced by Charlie Platt and Les Thatcher. And Jimmy's match was going to be the first of two today that were recorded in 1980, 44 years ago, 6 days before Christmas Day. The other match is later on in the Studcast. We're going to be talking about a match with Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose, which is going to be the future Midnight Express Incorporated.
Okay, Ron, so now we'll get our producer, Brian, to run that Jimmy Golden comeback match. Here it is.
Welcome to Southeastern Championship Wrestling. Outstanding television card today. But before we talk about that, Les, I think all eyes are set on 1981.
That's right. We're into a new year, or for some of us into it just a few days away. But Don Curtis has been in the 1981, and he's going to make wrestling here even tougher competitively than it has been in the past year, Charlie, with the return of an athlete who is certainly no stranger to anyone in this area, Ken Lucas.
Ken Lucas will be returning to Southeastern Wrestling along with Robert Gibson, Paul Orndorff.
Right, Orndorff, former North American heavyweight wrestling champion, a tough competitor. He'll be making his presence known in the area, and two very special wrestlers coming up in the month of February 1981. National Wrestling Alliance World Champion Charlie Harley Race and 7'4" Andre the Giant.
An outstanding year in store for wrestling fans throughout the Southeastern wrestling area. Today in action, we'll be seeing Jimmy Golden, who's just returned to the Southeastern area.
Our first match, one fall, 10-minute time limit. Your referee is Tommy Weathers. Tommy Weathers. Introducing in the corner to my left at 232 pounds from Montgomery, Alabama, Jimmy Golden. Jimmy Golden. His opponent at 265 pounds from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Frank LeVert. Frank LeVert.
Frank LeVert taking on Jimmy Golden. Golden just back into the Southeastern Wrestling area after staying off quite some time, staying out of professional wrestling altogether because of back injuries.
You know, Charlie, I was talking to Jimmy earlier in the dressing room, and in a way, the injury, of course, I can't say the injury was an advantage, but the fact that Jimmy had some time off, you know, to rest himself, not only physically, but mentally as well, and you need to get away from the pace. It's a grueling pace, the professional wrestling wars, and Jimmy back in action. Some question whether or not he can make that junior heavyweight limit at this time, but he certainly has his sights set on Jerry Stubbs, the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, and I think we'll find Jimmy Golden a gentleman who should be at the peak years of his career. Already the past 3 or 4 years has to be considered one of the very top junior heavyweights in the division.
Into a pinning position, count of one. Golden outweighed about 30 pounds.
30 to 35 pounds, that's right, Charlie. And, of course, Jimmy has always built his offense on speed. Of course, as we all get older, we have to alter some of our offensive abilities. Not that Jimmy is too old to be fast. The experience, you know, it teaches you one good move, one solid hold is worth 5 or 6 mediocre ones. And Jimmy has that speed. He holds it reserved when necessary. And it's certainly stood him in good stead throughout his career.
Head scissors by Leverett. We have a break.
I think LeVert will find out that 35 pounds that we're talking about, some 35, 40 pounds, won't be a huge advantage for him here. He does lack the experience. And again, the blinding speed of Jimmy Golden can well offset that 35 pounds.
Golden unleashing on LeVert.
Golden, very apt with either side of the ledger. He can wrestle you hold for hold or trade blows with you, as we're seeing here. And he turns LeVert over center ring with a kick to the midsection, Charlie.
Golden takes his man into a neck breaker position. That's going to be
that reverse neck breaker. We've seen Jimmy use that extensively since his return. It has been his key card, his ace in the hole, so to speak, and another strong win for Jimmy Golden.
I got to tell you, that took me back in time. It was so cool. It was great seeing Jimmy Golden again and his return match. It really takes you back to another day in time when you have the opportunity to see that. So, and by the way, folks that are listening on the audio podcast, if you subscribe to the new channel, the new streaming channel, and give me the name of it one more time, Stud. I'm getting used to it. Tennessee Stud.
Tennessee Stud Streaming.com.
Tennessee Stud Streaming.com. If you subscribe there, and we'll give you information on how to get that done, you can see everything that's happening. All right, so what was next on the show?
Well, this TV was really loaded with action, man. It had 5 TV matches rather than the normal 4. And one of those was an all-against-all 6-man elimination match, with the winner of that match on television getting $1,000 for just beating 5 other opponents and ending up the last man in the ring. That was done on purpose so that fans could learn a little bit about what these elimination matches look like.
Mm-hmm. All right, so who was in the next match?
That one was with Bob and Brad Armstrong. Condry and Rose had showed up at the set uninvited, and I think they learned how to do that from Don Carson, who was no longer with us. But they showed up uninvited at the set, and they started bragging about their tag team belts and that they were champions and saying they were unbeatable. And while at the same time, fans in the studio were going crazy watching the father and son team in the ring. It was really worth spending some time looking at. So it didn't take long for the Armstrongs to finish their opponents and then invite Condry and Rose, who were their future opponents, coming up in the next week, in this Christmas week. They were going to be having a chance to win their championship belts back. As Condry and Rose passed by on the ring there, they invited him to come on into the ring, but they decided maybe we'd just go right on to the dressing room. So Bob and Brad, I got to tell you, man, they were an amazing tag team. You would have thought they'd been wrestling together for years at this point. And then instead of that, they'd only been wrestling together for 3 weeks. So their upcoming tag championship match was going to be one of the best yet.
Wow. Okay. So who was in the next TV segment?
Well, that was Jerry Stubbs. And he came to the set to watch a video. It was of his last championship win over Norvell Austin. They'd had a series of matches, and Jerry had beaten him in most of them. And Stubbs was more confident than ever that this win was his best yet against him, and that he had finally beaten Norvell Austin so badly, he said, he was sure Austin was going to be ashamed to even show his face again. He won't be seen anymore. So about that time, the bell sounded for the next match, and Charlie Pratt brought up immediately the fact that Stubbs had a championship match the following week. He said, hey, Jerry, you got a match the following week against a masked man called a Shadow. And so he said, you know, and that's who's going to be in the ring. And he invited him to stay at the set, him and Les, and watch the match. So when the Shadow came out of the babyface dressing room on his way to the ring, the studio crowd exploded. They were laughing. And it was obviously because the Shadow was an Afro-American, Norvell Austin. He was wearing a white mask. And he pointed at Stubbs like I got your number now. And he strutted on up to the ring. And Stubbs went nuts, man, screaming at the top of his lungs. He said, that's Norvell Austin wearing a mask. He goes, you know, and I'm not going to wrestle Norvell Austin again. I beat him all these times, but he's not showing his face, at least, like I said. So Les said, you know, that they weren't going to be, wasn't going to be wrestling against. He said, Jerry, you're not wrestling against Norvell Austin. You're going to be wrestling against the Shadow. So the studio audience popped on that one, right? And boy, Stubbs didn't. He got out of control, man. And he started screaming about the new masked man. he said, look at him. He's probably going to lose this match. And it didn't take him. The Shadow didn't take a minute to beat his opponent. And guess what move he did, Dave?
It couldn't have possibly been a diving headbutt.
Yes, it was. It certainly was, man. And Stubbs stormed away from the set. He almost ran past the ring to avoid the Shadow on his way back to his dressing room, though. He's not really too excited about it.
You were right already about this being a loaded TV show. So this part was definitely loaded with plenty of laughs. All right, so how about the personality profile that was coming up? Who was on that?
Well, Big Ron Bass came to the profile set, man, and he had a handful of papers. He was going to join Charlie and Les at the set, and he started out with having the fact that he had just run Joe LaDuke out of Southeastern Wrestling, that nobody other than him was probably ever capable of that. And then he watched a short video of their second bull rope match, which was a loser leave, Southeastern. And obviously, Bass won the belt. He didn't win the belt, but he won the bull rope match, and he got his bull rope back, and Joe LaDuke was gone. So then Bass went straight to what I guess he came out there for. He asked them if they knew how long he had been in Southeastern. He's talking to Les and Charlie, you know. And both of them had guessed maybe it had been 5 months, they said, you know. And he said, you know, well, that's close enough, you know. And then he passed them the handful of papers. And he said, I want you guys to take a look at these. This is every card I have been on since I arrived here. And he goes, and obviously, they wouldn't have time to look at all those papers, but they looked at a few of them for a second there, and then he didn't stop at that, though. So he asked if they had any idea. He said, how many shots do you think I've had at the Southeastern belt in the 5 months that I've been here in Southeastern. And they had no idea, you know, and how many matches he had had for the Southeastern Championship in the 5 months he'd been there. So then he got very nasty with him about it, and he started screaming, you know, it's something about it, not a single damn one. He says, I haven't had one shot at winning the Southeastern Championship, you know, and and he says, and now I'm back here, you know, he says, and now they got that loser that lost a loser to leave town a couple of months ago, they got him back here wearing a mask, and he's the champion, right? And so the studio crowd nearby, they started booing him about that point. They were tired of hearing what his opinion was. And so Tennessee Stud was back there watching the monitor in the dressing room. He grabbed his Southeastern belt and he went out to the set. And as soon as the TV studio saw him coming, they let out a big roar. And so Bass jumped up from his seat. I guess he was expecting to have some kind of problem. And both Les and Charlie stepped between the two of them. And they were begging both of them to back off. Well, the Stud did, but only far enough to hold the belt over his head. And he said to Bass, this is what you want. Well, you might as well forget it, because you're not going to ever get this from me. And he said something about you not nearly enough man to make that happen. Well, that's all it took. So Bass took a swing, and well, they both went down on the concrete, and immediately, wrestlers started coming from everywhere to break it up, thank goodness. And both Charlie and Les were calling for the director to go to black and get to the end of the profile, to get out of this, right? So that happened almost instantly. But the scuffle on the concrete continued for a little longer before that got stopped.
Wow. I don't think anything like that had happened on a personality profile in a long time, if ever. So who was in the next TV match?
Well, it was going to be the second TV match recorded 44 years ago from the original TV show, which was shot 6 days before this upcoming Christmas card of 1980.
All right, good deal. All right, so our producer Brian is going to play the tag team match recorded in 1980. Here it comes.
Our next match, one fall, 10-minute time limit tag team match. Introducing in the corner to my left, at a combined weight of 423 pounds, Mike Jackson and Norvell Austin. Jackson and Austin. Their opponents at a combined weight of 472 pounds, Randy Rose and Dennis Condrey. Rose and Condrey.
The former Southeastern Tag Champions taking on Mike Jackson and Norvell Austin.
Junkyard Dog and Mike Jackson. I don't know if the fans here are familiar with Mike Jackson, but, you know, I saw him wrestle the first time in several years a couple weeks ago, Charlie, and this young man has come a long way, and he does lack a little bit in the weight, but good speed, good moves in that ring, and of course, they're facing a tough combination, Condrey and Rose, former Southeastern Tag Team Champions. I don't think I can impress enough about Condrey and Rose. A lot of fans immediately expect to see him posing in size and stature, wrestlers to be the top dogs. But Condrey and Rose are tough in as much as they kick away at opponents. They find a spot, they go to work, they spend the time there, they're tenacious with their style, and they're tough. They're very tough. But of course, they're right now wanting to prove a point, put those tag team belts back around their waists again.
That is exactly what they have on their minds. And I really think that they're going to be pursuing that matter more than anything else they've ever done in their career. Brad and Bob, father-son team of the Armstrongs, the current Southeastern Tag Champions. And we must say, excellent champions in Bob and Brad.
Nice switch by Norvell, but Rose catches the tag from his cousin, Dennis Condrey. You know, I think more than just the loss by Rose and Condrey, the embarrassment they feel because of the age and the inexperience of Brad Armstrong. But I don't think they should feel bad at all. This young man has proved himself to be a very, very tough competitor, along with his father, former Chuck. Tag team domination. Jackson takes a tag. We'll see action from him for the first time in our ring.
Arm twist on Rose. Arm drag takedown, and he... that arm bar comes down with that leg.
Mike Jackson applying the pressure on that arm as Rose trying to roll across is blocked by Jackson. They come up now. Mike Jackson still with the arm bar, but those well performed by Randy Rose dropped the young man from Birmingham, and the tag goes to Dennis Condrey.
Condrey takes that knee into the midsection of Jackson. Snap, fair takedown. But it's Jackson.
Good switch by Mike.
Good switch. Coming up with that hammerlock.
Traps the forearm, the right arm now, and relinquishes that to go back to the left arm, controlling from that point. Nice takedown by Condrey. Jackson holds on, but Dennis on top. And, of course, here's where the weight of Dennis Condrey will certainly play a large part, Charlie.
Exactly. Condrey now takes a command, what appears to be thumb into the throat.
Tag goes to Randy Rose. Rose moves in, takes command now. That flying elbow nails Mike Jackson, takes him down. And a one count, Jackson bails out.
Here we see those former champions come alive with that teamwork that they're so well known for.
Jackson trying to bail out there and switch into a hammerlock, but Rose was able to brace himself, let Jackson go, and move right back in on top. Jackson again with a good switch, but Rose blocking, and the tag goes to Dennis Condrey.
Condrey in now. Goes into the back of Jackson. Abdominal stretch by Condrey. And using extra leverage from Rose. Using that extra leverage from Rose, we have no submission.
Little help from Cuz, never hurt when the referee can't see it, Charlie. That's exactly what's going on there now. Jackson trying to make the tag to Norvell Austin, just inches away. Condrey blocks the attempt for the tag. Shoots his man cross ring. Elbow stops him, and down goes Jackson.
Down for the pin, count of one, and Jackson powers out. Front chancery again by Condrey.
Condrey and Rose both realizing this young man has a bit of speed there. You notice they're blocking, trying to keep him on that mat. He tags Norvell Austin, and a junkyard dog comes in to do his natural thing.
Tag is made with Randy Rose. Rose catching a series of rights and lefts from Austin. Headbutt takes his man into the turnbuckle high. Back body drop.
And Rose goes crashing to that canvas as Norvell moves in, tries for the kick. Rose moves out of the way, but Austin, still pressing for that advantage, comes high with a knee drop. Let's see if he gets the pin here. Rose out on the one. Rose driving the points of those fingers into the windpipe of Norvell Austin, being cautioned by referee Tommy Weathers. Rose goes to the tag, and of course, here's one of the keys of Condrey and Rose. Is the beautiful tags, the good timing, Charlie, has been a key ingredient for these two gentlemen.
Austin going into the wrong corner. And it's also interesting to watch these two and their tactics of blocking tags for the opposing team. They wear one man down, and they really keep him from making that tag.
They certainly do. Now the tag goes into Rose off that second rope with a shot. Condrey blocking down to the last second. We might reiterate here once again that a wrestler, once he makes the tag, has a five count to clear that ring. So until that five, they are the rules of professional wrestling. Rose crashing down with that forearm. He gets a two, but the dog is out and still doing business.
Tag is made with cousin Dennis Condrey. Condrey and boot to the midsection. Austin needing desperately to make that tag with Jackson. And so far, the Rose Condrey team has halted all efforts for Norvell to make a tag.
Austin trying to fight his way out of that corner. Rose Condrey doing a good job of blocking. The two-on-one situation certainly is no liking and serving them well. Power slam by Condrey on the junkyard dog in a two, and Austin is out.
Two count, and good he comes second, out of it.
Good second effort by Norvell Austin.
Shoulder smash, and both men are down.
Condrey bounced the back of his head on that one too, Charlie. He's stunned. Condrey up first to his knees. He makes the tag. Wise decision. Austin goes the same direction. He makes the tag. We're starting fresh with Mike Jackson, Randy Rose.
Jackson takes his man into the ropes, but it's Rose coming off of that boot. takes Jackson again into the rope. Elbow into the chest area for the pin. One count, and Jackson powers out.
Jackson hanging tough, and Austin and Jackson have given a good account of themselves here. Not having wrestled as a team in the past, considering all things, they're right in this one, Charlie. They've been in from the very beginning.
Full slam by Condry. And again, a one count on Mac Jackson.
Condry and Rose pecking away. They seem to just gain control, but never completely. Now blocking Jackson is Condry, makes the tag. Rose in now, and again they start chipping away the offensive armor of Mike Jackson. Tag goes to the dog once again.
Norvell Austin in, pounding away at Rose, having to fight both men off at this point. Condry coming in that ring.
Norvell and Mike have been able to keep a fresh man in when necessary. Rose and Condry have started to pick up the edge several times, but both Jackson and Austin have made timely tags. It has kept this match close to even, Charlie.
It's Randy Rose now with that chin lock on Austin.
Rose laying that weight in, wearing his man down, slowing Austin down, controlling him here. Hoping this time to keep Norvell out of that corner. You know, Rose and Condry are not the Dan Fouts of the San Diego Chargers. They're more like a Johnny Unitas. They're not the big play team. They'll peck away at you, catch you when you're unexpecting some sort of move, and come right back at you with it. And this is what they've done with Austin and Jackson.
The Junkyard Dog back up. Good shoulder smash. He makes the tag with Mike Jackson. Jackson. Series of connections to the
and this could change the tide of battle. Austin and Jackson could pick the tempo up here. Wait a minute. A double clothesline. Condry helping out from the outside the ring. Rose pulls it out with a three count, and you've got winners, Charlie.
And your winners of the match, a former Southwestern Tag Champion.
Hey, Stud, I tell you what, that was a great tag match right there, no doubt about it. And if you're listening, by the way, on the podcast, the regular Studcast that we do, you can see these matches as we do them on the Studcast at TennesseeStudStreaming.com. TennesseeStudStreaming.com, a simple fee, and you get set up, and you've got tons and tons to see, including that full 10-minute match right there. All right, so I had forgotten how good a team Condry and Rose were, and that was Norvell Austin's second match of this TV show after already being the Masked Shadow. So Condry and Rose beat a very young Mike Jackson from Birmingham, Alabama in that match, who was years later the ring announcer for Continental Wrestling. I had forgotten that fact.
Yeah, Norvell was really having a great time, man, messing with Jerry Stubbs back then. And believe it or not, Dave, Mike Jackson still wrestles today, 44 years later.
Wow, you got to be kidding. I mean, he has to be in his 60s. So, all right, take us to the last TV match of this excellent TV show from 44 years ago.
Well, to make sure fans understand how an elimination match worked, we made the last match of the TV show just that, an elimination match. In fact, it was a six-man, six guys in this one. And at $1,000 was going to be given to the winner. And the six men in it were Oki Shekina, Roy Lee Welch, Iron Mike Masters, Ricky Fields, Burrhead Jones, and Mr. Saito. And the match started with two men, one from each dressing room. They had won a coin toss among the wrestlers that were going to be in the event out there just a little bit later in the dressing room. And the one that won in the one dressing room was going to be against the winner that had won the coin toss in the other dressing room. That's how they got figured out who's going to start the match. So those two started the match. All the wrestlers, except for the starting two, stood on the floor. And they had to keep their hands on the ropes so that they could be tagged at any time to come in the ring. So the men in the ring could tag anyone of the men on the floor at any time they wanted to. And when that happened, the one they tagged had to take that guy's place in the ring. He got out and he stood on the floor. So when a wrestler beat somebody, the loser returned to the dressing room. And the winner picked his next opponent from all the men that were still outside the ring there. And so the match continued until there was only one man left. To me, it was like a mental match of strategy, this one. Those matches could last anywhere from, I've seen them last anywhere from 15 minutes to, sometimes I was in one that was an hour and a half long one time.
Wow.
So in my opinion, it is one of the most best alternative matches in wrestling back in that time frame.
All right, so how did this one on TV go, and who started it out?
Well, it went pretty quickly, Dave, because there was only six guys in it, for one thing. And five of those guys were like, they were kind of like boys compared to the one that was in there that was definitely a man. So, and we'll talk a little more about that in a second. So, Oki Shekinah and Roy Lee Welch had won the tosses in the dressing room, and Roy got the first win over Shekinah. Nobody tagged out during that first win between Roy and Shekinah. Then Shekinah went to the dressing room, and Roy chose Mike Masters, who was for his next opponent. And pretty soon in that second go-round between Roy and Mike Masters, Roy tagged out to Ricky Fields, who came in, and he was able to beat Masters. So then Ricky made a very bad decision, though. It was time for him to pick his next opponent, and he picked Mr. Saito. So Saito came in the ring, man, like a ninja. I mean, his first move was a suplex, and it was a suplex that none of us in the dressing room, all these television shows, guys watched their monitors very closely in the dressing room. He wanted to get an idea what other wrestlers were capable of, and to see how good some of these guys were. So none of us had ever seen this particular suplex before. It's like, so what did he do? How did he do that? You know, and pretty quickly, so Saito disposed of Ricky Fields. And then he turned to Burrhead Jones, and he pointed to him and fingered like, come on in, right? So when Burrhead started crawling up on the apron and coming through the ropes, he just grabbed him by the back of the neck and shot him across the ring. And when Burrhead came running back toward him, he belly to the back suplexed him, man, right on his face. Wow. And then he turned him over and he got the pin. So then the only man left was Roy Lee Welch. So within less than a minute, he got Roy Lee with a third different suplex, man. In less than 3 minutes, three different suplexes.
Wow.
He was a monster. So the less, you know, he had the money, and he got in the ring to announce the winner. And they had spent a little time, and I guess Don Curtis sent him out to find one. Les had a $1,000 bill. And Saito won the money. And so Les presented him with the money, and you could hear Saito bow, you know, and you could hear him say, he said, Saito, love American dollar.
Yeah, I bet. That's wild. You said Les had a $1,000 bill. How rare is that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can hardly find those boys, you know, but I guess Curtis had, he had a lot of connections when it came to money. So somehow they ended up with a $1,000 bill, and Saito ended up with it because he loved American dollar.
I love American dollar. What a great way to end a really super TV show. All right, so what happened the next week in all the matches, but especially the $5,000 elimination matches at the end of every night?
But Jimmy Golden was in his first night back, and he beat Oki Shekinah, and the fans seemed like they had forgotten. The fans cheered him. They were happy to see him, and they... You would have you would have thought they would have remembered that just 9 months ago when he got hurt, he was a heel. But, you know, I guess they felt sorry for him. And, you know, so Jimmy came back as more babyface than a heel for darn sure. Mr. Saito beat both Bob Owens and Burrhead Jones. And I think that thing, I went and watched it. I don't think that match lasted 3 minutes. And he beat both of those guys like there was nothing to it. I mean, he was a monster. He was one of the greatest Japanese I ever saw. Johnny Valiant beat Iron Mike Masters. In the United States Junior Heavyweight title match, The Shadow, man, pulled out a win over Jerry Stubbs. Now, Norvell Austin couldn't beat Jerry Stubbs, but The Shadow could. So, and then in the Southeastern Tag Championship match, Bob and Brad Armstrong, they regained their titles, their tag titles, from Conry and Rose. Tennessee Stud won a disqualification match over Ron Bass. And then we get to the $5,000 elimination matches that was in four of the cities. Not all six of them, but in four of them. And they were won by three different wrestlers in all the matches except for the Mobile match, which took place on the very first night of this Christmas series here, mm-hmm. Christmas mm-hmm. night series. And that very first night, elimination match turned out to be a really wild one. And in fact, it ended up with eight guys still down at the ringside. And that was Ron Bass and Mr. Saito, Dennis Condrey, Randy Rose. And there was Bob Armstrong and Brad Armstrong was there, Johnny Valiant and a Tennessee Stud. So those were the eight guys that were down to the last eight in the elimination match. And that's when all hell broke loose, man. The fight started at the ringside, and then it just went everywhere. Went all over. The match obviously was declared a no contest. The same eight wrestlers were going to be involved next week in all four of the major cities, including Mobile, on New Year's night again. They would be there again. In an eight-man tag, Texas Death Match, with the winning team getting $5,000 in prize money. And they fought all over the building. I mean, both up and downstairs, and even out in a couple of them were outside the building. So it was a wild night in Mobile.
Okay, so, I mean, that really must have been a real brawl in Mobile. So in the next Studcast, the main event was going to be the same eight wrestlers that wouldn't be pulled apart wrestling for $5,000 four nights that week. So what was the attendances set us up for all six cities Southeastern wrestled in on Christmas week 1980? And I think you're adding a couple from the Panhandle of Florida.
Yes, yes. We've got the two cities in Florida and the Panhandle. That's going to give us the six nights. So the week started off, like I said, the first night started off on Christmas night, which was a Thursday, in Mobile's main arena. And we had 9,000 people there. And as I said, there was a war started, man, in an elimination match last week. And the fight was anywhere but the ring, man. It was everywhere, all over that building for about 15 minutes, it seemed like. And it was truly an elimination match. It looked like all eight of them were trying to eliminate each other. So in Friday in Dothan was a Christmas celebration. Houston County Farm Center had 5,600 fans. Montgomery had moved to a Saturday because its normal night was Wednesday, and New Year's Eve was a terrible night, so we had taken Montgomery and moved its night from a Wednesday to a Saturday. And boy, fans reacted to that one. I can tell you that 5,500, a record crowd ever for Montgomery. Sunday was always Pensacola's night. And the Christmas spirit was there too, man. 5,300 fans showed up. Monday in Birmingham was no surprise after the way every city had responded mm-hmm. all week. We expected it to be big, and Boutwell was packed again, man. the second biggest crowd since that first night. And they put 7,000 people in there. Had 6,200 in Birmingham. Tuesday night, Panama City. Fans there broke an all-time record for Panama City, 4,900.
Wow.
So I told you, Dave, it's going to be big.
Yeah.
But you know, and when I added it all up, man, I was like, wow. 35,900 fans in six nights of Christmas, 1980.
Man, you did predict that earlier in the show that the attendances would be big. That 35,900 is only 100 fans short of a 6,000 average for six nights in a row. So that had to be a new attendance record, even bigger than the triple world championship cards.
Yes. Not a lot of us, you know, expected to have that all-time record to that point. And then we had some really good talent coming. We had really changed some people already. We had a guy like Saito, who's just amazing. We had arriving on the next Thursday night, the following January 1st, on 1981, January 1st, Paul Orndorff. And he was going to be another of those young Southeastern superstars, man. We developed so many young guys. This Paul was in an early age, but by you could tell he's destined to become a Hall of Famer, and he certainly did.
Okay, and sorry to say, but we're not going to have enough time for a learning tree question on this episode, but I do have a question about where we're going to be riding next week.
Next week, and we're going to be coming back to open the week in Mobile, Alabama's main arena again. And this time it's going to be the first of a 4 8-man Texas death tag matches across the territory, with $5,000 going to each one of the winning teams.
Wow.
And I couldn't forget, man, it was an 8-man tag match in the Mobile main arena 9 months earlier when Jimmy Golden hurt his back badly enough to have to retire from the sport. And he's going to be in his second week back next week, and it will be Paul Orndorff's first week ever in Southeastern. And on the TennesseeStudStreaming.com channel's next new studcast, there's going to be two more classic matches from 44 years ago. These will take place in the first week of January 1981. One of them is going to feature a TV match with the hottest tag team in America at this point, Bob and Brad Armstrong. Wow, were they kicking some butt, man. Fans just loved them. They went crazy about them. And they're going to be on TV in the TV match against Ron Bass and Oki Shekina. And the other is going to expose some of the hatred, man, that's going on in these 8-man tag matches. So it's a little bit of everything in next week.
I love it. It's like taking a ride back in time, watching those matches from 44 years ago. The TennesseeStudStreaming.com channel is now the hottest place and the only place on the internet where you can find classic old school wrestling matches in every new studcast. For only $4.99 per month, you're going to be a fan all over again, no doubt about it. The channel is daily adding more classic, what would be considered lost TV shows from the old Southeastern Continental and USA wrestling days. It's going to become the biggest thing in wrestling, absolutely. So do yourself a favor, subscribe now, TennesseeStudStreaming.com. TennesseeStudStreaming.com, only $4.99 per month, or save 15% and get a full year for only $49.99. It's the absolute best deal in wrestling. All right, any final comments today, Stud?
Yeah, I want to thank everybody, obviously, man, for their support. I'm really, really happy and pleased to hear so many people enjoying and these comments, appreciative comments, man. And I really, really love these fans that are into old school. And they're getting to see it in a form and fashion in which they never have before. And I think it's going to be really a growing big time as time goes by here. And the old school to me is greatest wrestling of all time. And, you know, I guess I'm probably a little bit biased to that, but I think there's a whole lot of people that probably would agree. So please take care of yourselves out there and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/dsummers955, on Twitter, X, it's Dave_Doohan. On Instagram, it's instagram.com/DavidSummersProductions. And hit me up anytime at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC. Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.